Hello, welcome to The Moment That Made Me. This time,
the world's oldest soldier came through the door. Anyway, right, that lot over there think you lot in here are thick as shit, but you're not.
From youth detention through the SAS to best-selling author.
I was starting to like this army business. I thought, well, I've got to get a grip of this education stuff. The guy said, right, remember, you've just read a book and it didn't kill you. I went, yes, sir. Yeah. Even the very first book, Bravo 2-0, the first draft was like a patrol report, quite frankly. It was like, and then the publishers went, well, yeah, this ain't good.
The moment that made Andy McNab was a short, sharp shock in December 1976.
Basically, I was sort of an acne-covered 16-year-old. I'd come out of juvenile detention, which was then was called the Borstal system, which was cancelled in the early 80s. I joined because there was a social mobility project going on, trying to get kids out of the Borstal system, because there was no rehabilitation or education, because it was all about this thing called the short, sharp shock. So there was this social mobility thing going on. And one of the outlets was joining the military, and the guys who turned up just happened to be the army. So I landed up in as a 16-year-old, about 16 and a half, as an infantry junior leader down in Shorncliffe in Kent.
And how had you got yourself into juvenile detention? What happened?
Well, the really glib answer is that you got caught, but there was a block of flats in southeast London. It's near Sydenham. It's near Crystal Palace. And as far as we're concerned, that's where all the rich people lived. So there was six flats, you know, three stories. And we just sort of I don't know how it all happens, but you just like land up like smashing the windows, going in and grabbing stuff. And I got a check. I didn't even know what to do with it, but I thought I cracked it, so I found a check. There was three of us who went back the next day, master criminals that we are, and then we got caught, because there's always, the really stupid ones, me included, that always go back and try again. So the police are waiting. So I got caught. At that time, the government of the day were going to deal with this thing called, I think we were juvenile delinquents, and they had this system within the Borstals called short, sharp shock. The idea was to get you in there and just scare you so you wouldn't reoffend. And the system didn't work, and it was all abandoned again in the 1980s, because there was more, it was something like about 78% reoffending that went on with, in fact, 16, 17, 18-year-old kids when they came out.
So you were in a juvenile detention when the moment that made you happened. What was that moment that made you?
Well, it was this social mobility project. One of the groups that came in was the army. So we all sat there and watched this recruiting film of a helicopter pilot flying really low over the beaches of Cyprus. Nobody had no idea where Cyprus was, but it didn't matter, because it was like sun was shining, all that sort of stuff. And they said, right, who wants to be a helicopter pilot in the army? And we all put our hands up. And we went off to Sutton Coalfield for 3 days of assessment. And it was clear that all of us, no way we're going to be flying helicopters. You wouldn't even get close enough to spit at the thing, let alone fly it. And I was offered a place in the infantry.
And so you were in the IJLB, the Infantry Junior Leaders Battalion. What was it, and what was it like?
Well, it was a year's training, and the idea was to teach you to be the future leadership, the junior and senior NCOs of the infantry. So there was about 1,100 junior soldiers there, and for the first 3 months, I hated it anyway. I thought it was worse than Borstal. There were room inspections all the time, and all this sort of this bedding in period and all that marching and shouting and all that sort of stuff. And I really didn't like it, but it really took about that period of time to understand why, everybody was, there was like, two room inspections a day. We were doing, working on Saturdays up until Sunday mornings. So you get sort of Sunday afternoons off until Monday morning. And it was just a solid sort of year of training. And I really didn't understand it. And also, because I hadn't looked at or really understood what was going on during the selection process at Sutton Coalfield, I thought I was signing on for 3 years, which was the minimum engagement at that time. But if you join as a junior soldier, you sign on for 6 years because they want to get your money's worth out of you. So not only did I have to shave every morning? I didn't have to shave till I was about 18. You know, and I had acne, I cut my tops off of the zits. And then finally learning, like, you know, thinking, right, the army's ripping me off even more because I've got to do 6 years rather than three. So that first couple, I didn't like it at all.
Can you remember when that person from the army first walked through the door? Can you remember what you thought?
Yeah, I thought, easy exit. This gets me out of this problem because I didn't like the detention. And I thought, well, you know, I'll do it. I'll get out as soon as I can, or they'll chuck me out. It doesn't really matter. All I wanted to do was get out of the Borstal system. I thought it was great. And I joined an infantry regiment, light infantry regiment at the time. They're the Rifles now, but it used to be the Royal Green Jackets. To me, it sounded like a football team. I hadn't a clue.
It's really interesting because when you were saying that you were being trained, that you actually hated it at first, at what point did that change?
It really sort of, there was the amalgamation of things, really. It's sort of after about sort of that bedding in period, you know, that sort of 2-3 month period, sort of understanding why it was as strict as it was, because you've got to get all these 16-year-olds and 17, well, 16-year-olds, literally, you get out when you're 17. So you get all these 16-year-olds and trying to, you know, to get them become sort of one, you know. So it took a while for me to understand the system. But for me, it was the 3 month period. We all shouted out the block, you know, you have your morning inspection and all that sort of stuff. All shouted on the block in free rank. We're in the army now, so we march away. And we marched off to a different part of the camp, which was the Army Education Center. And up until then, I didn't even know the Army sort of had an Army Education Corps, they were called at the time. And I thought, right, the Army's ripping me off again because I've got to go back to school. So we went into these classrooms and you're in the army now, you know, just shut up and sit there. And for us sort of 16-year-old junior leaders, the world's oldest soldier came through the door. Now I know he was 40, but it was like, because infantry's young anyway, but we're like 16. And what we learned eventually, he used to be a regiment sergeant major in an infantry battalion and got a commission, become an LE officer, but wanted to go into the Army Education Corps and go back to IGLB because that's where he started. And what he said to us, it not only changed my life, but everybody there, quite frankly, is he walked in, we know, shut up, you know, so he's walking up and down looking at us. And he went over to the windows. We're right on the edge of camp. And, you know, there was, the fence and the barbed wire and all that stuff. And over the other side of the playing fields was a small town called Cheriton. And IGLB was down in Shorncliffe near Folkestone in Kent. Anyway, right, that lot over there think you lot in here are thick as shit, but you're not. The only reason you lot can't read and write is because you don't read and write. So today that all changes. And what he then explained was that the reason we were sort of there and not flying helicopters, we were in the infantry, was that all of us had a reading and numeracy age of between 9 and 11, which is now in education policies, key stage 2. And it sort of really sort of dawned on me then that, yeah, he's right. Because, it, obviously the squaddy newspaper was, you know, the Sun newspaper. So naffy break, you get a pipe of Vimto and you're sort of, you stay in kidney pie by the Sun. And, certainly, there's not a lot of reading on page 3. That was all right. Turn it to the sports. And I couldn't really truly understand what was being, what was on the page. And now, I write for tabloids, I write for broadsheets, even write for the Financial Times, but as a 16 coming on to 17-year-old, I really couldn't even read the Sun newspaper properly. And so what happened was that, that first sort of period with the educator, and education was 3 times a week in the evening after you finished your day's training. And first book we read, all of us, was a book that was for 10-year-old primary school kids, and it was called Janet and John Book 10. And it was a series of books, Janet and John, brother and sister, and they that climb trees and, you know, all that sort of stuff. So we all went through it during the evenings. And then on Friday evening, we all had to go and see the educator individually, read the book, read the small vocab on the back, spell the words and explain what the words meant. And then what he said, right, close the book, which I did. And then the guy said, right, remember, you've just read a book and it didn't kill you. I went, yes, sir. Yeah. And he said, but more importantly, remember, every single time you read something, doesn't matter what it is, poster, magazine, you know, it doesn't matter, book, doesn't matter. Every time you read something, you get a bit of knowledge. And the more knowledge you got, the more power you've got to do the things you want to do, as opposed to people telling you what to do because they got more power. Do you get that? And I went, yes, sir, which I didn't. You know, I just wanted to get out. But he was absolutely right. I sort of laid in the block. We used to live in these like 24 bed sort of blocks. And I thought, you know what? I've just read a book. He was right. And, you know, I've got a bit of knowledge about Janet and John climbing a tree. But it really didn't matter. You know what I mean? It really didn't matter. And then what happened was that he knew it. I didn't know it. And none of us really knew it. But once you start reading, once you started getting that knowledge and that power, it becomes infectious. And and obviously, the army had to educate people like me, not only to take information in, but to give information out, you know, if you're going to be one of these, you know, the future NCO of the army. So it not only changed my life totally, not just in the military, but certainly when I got out, when I got into, you know, to writing and now sort of, you know, producing sort of TV shows now in America, you know, it's none of that would have happened unless I sat in that classroom with the world's oldest soldier coming in and just explaining the facts of life and getting in the grip of us, basically.
What was it about that the world's oldest soldier that was so special?
Do you know, it's normally, I think, number one, he was his age, because he looked like a dinosaur compared to even the rest of the officers at IGLB, you know, because obviously they're, you know, they're young sort of captains, you know, everybody's sort of fairly young in the infantry. So all of a sudden, this really old guy came in. But actually, what he did, he understood because, again, we found all this later on, that he was exactly the same. He came in with a reading age of a 10-year-old and done the whole sort of, you know, non-commissioned officer thing, you know, become a warrant officer, and then got a commission, which I didn't even realize that you could do that in the army. You know, what, you know, again, what did I know? I was like 16. And so it was not only approachable, and he understood, but he was also at the same time inspirational. And I don't know if he knew that he was or not, because it wasn't sort of this big evangelical sort of talk he used to do, but he was just inspiration. We go, oh, right. Well, number one, he's in RSM. Everyone was scared of the RSM. So, you know, because he's a powerful lad. And then all of a sudden he became an officer. I thought, this is amazing. It's amazing.
And was it also the first time in your life you'd actually felt valued?
Yes, very much so. I went to 9 schools when I was a kid, 9 primary schools, all in South London. We sort of moved around a lot, you know, we got evicted and, you know, all that sort of stuff. And also I didn't like school anyway. So there was always this thing about like being at the bottom of society. And that was one of the reasons why we'd go to places like Sydenham, because that's where all the rich people lived. You know, we didn't like them. We didn't realize you had to work to get that money to buy that flat sort of thing. You know, that was certainly beyond my comprehension. And all of a sudden you had, all right, you was in these big blocks, you know, it's 24 block beds, but you had your bed space. I used to sleep in the front room for about 2 years. Because there weren't enough space, and everybody, like, you know, both parents smoked. Everybody was smoking. You had to wait for them to go to bed before you could go to sleep on the settee, and it would stink of smoke, all that sort of stuff. And all of a sudden, you had your bed space, and obviously, it was ripped apart every morning. It was getting inspected, and all that sort of stuff. But it was yours and your responsibility, and you were paying for it. So all of a sudden, it was referred to as your bed space. It's yours. And all the training staff, training within the platoons were sergeants. And they would always talk about the reason we do this, as opposed to the reason you're going to do it. The reason we do this is, you know, so all of a sudden you felt part of something, just not only practically with your bed space and your training and all that sort of stuff. This is what we do because you're one of us now. But actually, you know, without realizing it emotionally, you know, he felt part of something, which I really liked. And I couldn't understand why some of the you know, basically we're kids, and when I was 16, you know, some of them got out really early because they just didn't like it because they, you know, they had, which I realize now, they had a pretty stable sort of environment in their own houses with their families, and they didn't like being away. And I couldn't understand that because I thought it was great.
So there you are. You've read your first book. You're getting a glimpse of what the potential is for yourself. Can you just tell me a bit how that changed your life going forward and what happened in the ensuing like days and weeks?
Yeah, certainly at that stage, what it was all about, they're going, well, look, you can be the best soldier on the planet, but unless you get certain academic qualifications, you know, at corporal and then again at sergeant, you're not going to get promoted. So all of a sudden I think, well, I was starting to like this army business. I thought, well, I've got to get a grip of this. I've got to get a grip of this education stuff because, you know, I want to be a corporal. I want to be a sergeant. I want to do all that sort of stuff and maybe one day become an RSM, like the educator. So all of a sudden there become this, I understood that the education was part of what you did there. And that, again, that carried on in once I got to the battalion. And even when I sort of joined the Special Air Service, what I found really interesting was that on a good day, 600 operators in the Sabre squadrons on a good day, the education centre in Hereford is massive, absolutely massive. But you know, and because you know, you learn demolition, so you learn how to blow things up, and you know, like the films, the bridges blow up and all that. It's maths that blow the bridges because you've got to work out different formulas to place the charges and the amount of explosive you're going to use, plus the shape of it. And there's set formulas that you have to learn and put them in your head. Because if you're doing sort of covert recces to blow a bridge, you can't have your little Wade memoir in your top left-hand pocket. So all of a sudden, you've got to learn them. And one of the things that this educator constantly drummed into us was that you're not thick, you're just uneducated. So if you don't know something, go and ask somebody who does. They'll fall over themselves to tell you because you're taking an interest. And then they'll tell you. And if you don't get it, ask again, and then you will get it. So I took that all the way through the battalion, and certainly during within the Special Air Service. Because again, demolitions training, even signals training, you know, before you get your hands on the kit, you're back in the classroom, you know, learning. Yeah. Mathematics and you know, all these formulas, you know, in the signals, you're in the labs, you know, learning Morse code, even languages, you're back in the classroom. So you don't know, ask.
And Andy, you mentioned your military career. This education famously took you into the army, 8 years in the Royal Green Jackets and 10 years in the SAS. Do you think that could have happened without that moment?
No, not at all. Chances are I wouldn't have been able to get through that first round of education anyway, you know, to become a corporal. So nothing would have happened both in the Green Jackets, certainly in the regiment, but just as importantly, outside, you know. So, you know, nothing would have happened within publishing and TV and all these sort of things that I got involved with afterwards. It simply wouldn't have happened. You know, I've got involved in IT startups in the United States and sort of been part of two companies within that 5-year span where you're trying to build them up and flog them on. And I've done it twice. With American partners, but done it twice. I knew nothing about how this stuff works, but you know, if you don't know, you just ask and you learn it and you go, all right, well, let's do it. And it's been successful. Sold two companies. It's fantastic.
Yeah, and as part of that post-army career, you have written more than 50 books now. It seems incredible for someone who struggled to read a copy of The Sun at the age of 16.
It's amazing. Even the very first book, in Bravo 2-0, I thought, well, okay, well, I'll give it a go. And the first draft was like a patrol report, quite frankly. It was like, and then the publishers went, well, you know, this ain't good. I said, well, how do you make it better? He says, well, it's too dry. And so the publisher told me to read Joe Simpson's Touching the Void, which isn't, the world's biggest book, you know, about his experience, you know, climbing and the injuries that he had. And he said, if you can give that sense of place in and Jeopardy in Bravo 2.0, then it's worth publishing, because the way that Simpsons describes, you know, the ropes tangling and the ice and him falling through the ice and the injuries and all that sense of Jeopardy and Jeopardy in place is fantastic. So I've read it loads of times. Yeah, I've seen the film, I've been to the stage play, all the stuff. I went and listened to him as well years ago. Amazing how he describes that. And because I learned from him, I learned from the books, I learned from the play as well. And it from there, it was like, well, okay, that works. I was working for a private military company at the time in Colombia, because that's the reason I got out. And I got a phone call from the publishers, and they went, you know, this Bravo 2.0, this book's doing all right. I went, great. And they went, well, do you want to do another one? And I'm thinking, what do you think? You know, gets a flight out of Colombia. I was, you know, after a 2-week patrol in a rainforest, gets back to the UK, and I'll get into this writing business, and I'll find out how you do that. Which I did. Because, you know, again, people fight to tell you.
And since you mentioned it, Bravo 2.0, obviously you're extremely famous for having written that, writing about your experience being parachuted into enemy behind enemy lines in Iraq. And famously, you were taken prisoner, you were tortured, incredibly difficult experiences. That 16-year-old arriving at IJLC, had you known what was going to come ahead and that it would actually inspire this huge writing career, what would you have thought?
Well, I wouldn't have believed it. I thought it was all rubbish, quite frankly. One of the problems that I had, even at the IJLB, really, it took the time to get into the battalion, was looking literally over the parapet. You know, all I knew. I went to Margate once when I was a kid, so I went to the beach once. Other than that, it was just the postcodes area, you know, wherever I was. That was my world. I didn't realize what else was out there. And even work, the reason I didn't bother about sort of school and all that, I thought, well, you know, I want to get a job. So I thought, well, it'd be London Transport. I'll get a council flat and a Mark II full Cortina, and I've cracked it. So there was no looking over the parapet. So once I got in the battalion, the first posting just for a small while was in Gibraltar, you know, and I thought, this is amazing. And then all of a sudden you realize there's a lot more out there and a lot of possibilities, so you just got to grab them.
And of all those life and near-death experiences, you've had such a rich life. When we were talking about the chat we were going to have today before this conversation, we were saying we were quite surprised in a way, or a lot of people would be surprised at that moment, that education, that educator, the instructor meeting that person, that was the moment you chose, was the moment that made you. Of all the things you've experienced, it does seem fairly surprising.
Well, I think that nothing would have happened unless I was sitting in that classroom, good and bad. And the way that I looked at the time in the military is that they gave me, it's like a mutual contract, they gave me loads of stuff. You know, it just wasn't the pay and all that sort of stuff. You know, it's even that, again, that emotional connection as I was part of something, which I really sort of liked. You're part of something. So you're part of that contract is they want you to do some bad stuff because you're in the infantry or you're in, you know, you're in UK SF. So if you look at, I don't know, the experiences, even as a young guy, 18-year-old in Northern Ireland, you know, the very first tour contacts, you know, a colonel got shot down in a helicopter. One of the patrol was blowing up, all that sort of stuff going on. I looked at it as a mutual contract. They were giving me just as much as they wanted from me. So even the Iraq experience, well, certainly within the regiment, it's sort of the argument is, lads, if you don't like it, you can always get out. You know what I mean? It's a mutual contract. You volunteered for that. So, you know, sometimes it goes good, sometimes it goes bad. But the one constant thing, still now, was sitting in that classroom at IJLB, without a doubt.
And perhaps less well known, since you left the military, you're also been a campaigner, including working on projects to help people in prison with their literacy. is that about wanting others to have the same moment that you had?
Yeah, it really started with the military. I used to go into Catterick, you know, the training establishment at Catterick and Harrogate, going in there. Just, again, you know, they're all sort of young soldiers, you know, so you tell a few war stories, all that sort of stuff. And then, but talk about that value of education. And quite frankly, you know, you can be a great soldier, but unless you've got it, you ain't going to get promoted. There's that sort of stuff. So it really started from there. And then I was approached by one of the charities that work in prisons, because one of the biggest occupational groups in prisons are ex-military. And, you know, at one stage, everybody thought it was because of PTSD and, you know, the politics around that. But actually, it wasn't. There was a big survey that was done over 2 years. And basically, it's young men, alcohol and violence. And so you got these people in prison. And again, you know, other, you know, prisoners come to these talks as well. So, and again, because they all want to know about, you know, the SAS and, you know, all those, you know, say, so tell the war stories, all that sort of stuff. But then say, lads, look, you've got a bit of free time here. So why don't you get your numeracy and your reading abilities up? Because then you might be able to compete when you get out. Because it's not as if you're going to walk out and everything's going to be great. You've got to be able to compete, and you've got enough sort of negative stuff coming anyway, coming out from the detention systems. So therefore, get an education, start a time to compete. Because again, you know, the overall population, the average reading ability is of an 11-year-old. In the prison population. And you know, you could argue, well, it's one of the reasons why they're there, because they can't get out there and compete. So it's quite good. I enjoy it.
And you have a particular interest in helping veterans. And your new project is called We Served. Can you just tell us a bit more about it?
Yeah. It's a system where what the people are trying to do is amalgamate all the services veterans and serving people will need. So that's everything from, you know, what we expect of, you know, things like discounts within stores, finance and preferential banking, finance, you know, all the sort of stuff that people need in the real world. So there's that. We've got cheap medical insurance for individuals and for their families, 24 access to doctors. We're signposting, obviously, the mental health facilities as well. So there's this amalgamation, a one-stop shop, but for real life sort of situations, you know, people with, you know, with kids, with, you know, the cost of living, with, you know, banking, with medical care, just trying to get it all together and make it cheaper and more accessible.
So when you look back at that moment, the moment that made you, what do you think the lessons are for the rest of us from what you learnt?
No one's thick about anything. It doesn't exist. You're just uneducated about it. So if you don't know it, go and find somebody who's going to show you how to do it, and you can do it. It's no one's thick. They're just uneducated. That's all. And so if you want it, you can get out there and access it. And one of the things that I found when I got out of the military, which is sort of taken for granted when you're in the military, and I realized how valuable it was that it's, you know, whatever you want to call it, work ethic or all that, but it's very, very simple. Just turn up on time, you know, with the kit you need and do the best job possible. And that's simply it. And it's so valuable outside. I couldn't believe it. And I still, you know, it's the three things I still do now. Yeah, that's why I was there 5 minutes, you know, coming on online here to make sure it's right. Because, you know, you said at the top of the hour, and I'm going, right, well, do 5 minutes before. Just be on time.
And what would you say to someone who's struggling to learn right now and struggling to believe in themselves?
I think that it is difficult because there's so much, you know, obviously the media is quite negative in the way of these things, because obviously that's, you know, a negative is always a good thing for the media to use. But don't listen to that. Listen to yourself. So if you, again, it's just like pushing on yourself and have a bit of self-reliance and go, do you know what, I'll do it. And then you give it a go, and you know, you might not get as far as you think you're going to get, but you might get in, you know, 20-30%, and that's a start. Because they, you know, now we're online, we've got access to everything. So even if you're embarrassed about it, it doesn't matter. Just do it in your kitchen. No one's ever going to know.
So you read your first book when you were 16. What do you read now?
At the moment, well, it changes, actually. The best book at the moment is what you're reading. But I've been reading quite a bit of Dickens, actually. And the reason is that obviously it's all sort of, you know, in a different timescape. But actually what really works for Dickens, and that's why it's still so popular now, and there's TV and there's, you know, radio plays, all that sort of stuff, is that it's about people and the way that people think and the way that people act when they interact with each other. So you can literally take out the horses and carriages and, you know, have them cars, take out the coal fires and have central heating. And it could be a modern day story. So, so easy, because it's about people. And that's why things like Bridgerton and all these sort of period things work, because it's about people, because nobody's changed. You know, the way we think might have different attachments because we've got smartphones and all that. But actually, fundamentally, it's the same as they fought 100 years ago and 200 years ago.
And if you met that the world's oldest soldier, the guy who actually transforms your life today, what would you say to him?
Thank you. It's similar to that. An amazing job. And I don't even know if he knew what he used to do. Because, again, it wasn't just me. But I don't even know if he knew what he was doing. You know, I have no idea if he sort of realised that it would change people's life. No idea.
Andy McNab, it's been great speaking to you. Thank you so much for telling us about the moment that made you.
Thank you.